Okay. Okay.
Okay, getting back to the rabbit. This rabbit. Okay, the story's going to be about how a rabbit got the lion to Africa. The story is about this lion who was always in the woods on the lookout for people because he was very old, and one of the simplest, I guess, animals that you could catch was humans. I guess he started finding out how their instincts are, how they live, and this animal started preying on humans. And at that time, all the animals spoke to Indians, and they spoke back and forth. They communicated. And one day this hunter went out from a small village, and he never returned. So they sent a hunting party after him, look for him, and they didn't find him. But a little bit later on in the afternoon, they found a human bone, and they knew what had happened to this man. So they were walking back, and they came across this rabbit. And they asked the rabbit if he saw what had happened. He said, "Yeah, I was walking through the woods, and I seen this lion jump him and ate him up. So, you know, I've seen that lion around, and he's getting old, and, you know, he just picks on animals that are defenseless and are just very unaware that he's around, and he's very old and crafty." So he says, "Well, at that time," he says, "well, you give me some clothing and food, I'll show you how to get rid of him, or I'll get rid of him for you." They said, "Well, all right." So they hired the rabbit to go ahead and go look for this lion and get rid of him. So he was walking, and he was walking through the woods and looking for a lion. Then he finally came across him. He was sitting there. So he went up there and started talking to him. And see, the rabbit's so crafty that he's pretending that he just came across him accidentally, not looking for him or anything. And at that same time, he's scheming on how he's going to dispose of this lion. And as it goes on, they become pretty good friends. And that lion is also sneaking, crafty. He's trying to figure ways how to get that rabbit. And there's this, now they're playing on the same level of how they're going to outdo one another. The lion's starting to get hungry, and the rabbit knows that he's getting hungry. So they start talking about what they eat, what lions like, and what rabbit likes, and all this. And as the story goes on, they reach a certain point. As they were walking through the woods, the lion, being unaware of what the rabbit was doing, the rabbit had led that lion to the shoreline. It was in the afternoon, and the lion says, and the rabbit says, "Well, I'm gonna go catch some fishing. I'll help you eat." He says, "All right." He says, "Where do you want me to start the fire?" He says, "Well, start it over there by the shoreline." At that time, the tide was going out, and he asked him to build a fire pretty close by the shoreline so you wouldn't get the woods on fire. So he walk out there to the shoreline, and he starts the fire and everything, and the rabbit goes fishing. And as he's fishing, he knows that the tide's going out, and if he could get that line in that tide, that'd be one way to get rid of him. So he throws his line out there, and he's waiting. He feels something real heavy and big, and he asks that lion to come over there and help him. So he hands that pole to the lion, and the lion's hanging on to it, and the rabbit pushes him in the ocean. As the tide's going out, it keeps pulling him farther and farther out, and you can see him. You can see him hollering at the rabbit to help him, but the rabbit is standing there watching him. He's laughing at him. And then every time the tide goes out, the lion gets farther and farther away from the shoreline. And that's why the lion's in Africa, because that's where he ended up at. And this is just one of the stories that I heard.
That's good. That's really good. I know there. It's interesting because the rabbit has figured in a lot of folklore for different cultures, but perhaps the Seminole tribe and also some of the other Native American tribes had the rabbit as a character before some other people did. Do you think that other people took up the rabbit character?
I think that's a pretty good possibility. I think that getting back to that story about that rabbit, I think you mentioned about that burr rabbit. I think that there is a certain indication, because in that story, I think in that movie, there's a black gentleman sitting there telling a story when they were having, I think, the slaves and everything back in those days. Some of them would run away from the, I guess, the white slaves and then get into the Indians, and the Indians would hide them out for a while. So I think there was that communication where they might have heard that story, mm-hmm. and taken it back to them.
Right.
Because it's pretty interesting of how certain things, or certain, I guess, events usually come about because of a certain ingredient or a certain mm-hmm. combination. Or,
right. And then it comes back, and it's changed a little bit, but it's taken a little bit from here and there, and
yeah.
and you know, it's changed. But there was a really early communication between runaway slaves and the Seminoles.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In some ways, you were very similar in that you were both runaways in the beginning, and were able to outwit.
Yeah, I think so.
The white slave owners, or the at that time the white people who were trying to run off the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think any time when you're, I guess, oppressed by other people or anything, you kind of unite with people who are in the same mm-hmm. I guess situation. So there's a lot of give and take situation that you wouldn't normally give or be associated with. But at that time, I think there was a great deal of hostility. So. And I think you made friends with, you know, who was on that same level.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do you feel at this point in time in the 1980s that there is still maybe a lot of hostility on the part of the tribes towards white culture, or do you feel that there's just a different feeling now? Or how do you see the future of the Seminole tribe, for instance, going?
I think Florida, I think we're pretty well situated. We have different groups of people coming through here, and I was asked the same question not too long ago. And one of the things that I've seen and I felt is that this place is a retirement area for a lot of non-Indians who come here to retire and take life easy. And a lot of these people, they have an opportunity now to quit fighting the world and just sit back now. And once they've relaxed and start looking at other things or areas that they were always curious about, now they have time for it. And there's a communication built there. And I think that interest in what they have and what they want to know is pretty interesting, because we want to explain to them what the Indians are, not just what they saw in movies, but the actual Indian telling a non-Indian what it's like to be an Indian. And this is there's this bond right there that the interest has started. And I think that living in Florida, we have this opportunity to do this. And then once this communication comes across, and the final point is that the information has been given, now they've become more aware of what the Indian people are about. I think then we start getting, I guess, more allies or more people aware of what the Indian people are in Florida about. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that people are beginning to have a renewed respect for, this is my own feeling, for Native American culture, in that we've begun looking back and seeing that there are a lot of things that are very valuable that might be lost if we just keep continuing on our Western course of progression, just building up things and you know, our whole thing of progress, when uh-huh. really there are a lot of things that the Indians had it right from
yeah.
the beginning, and I think there's a renewed respect there, and maybe there'll be more of a give and take between the cultures. Do you think that your cultural heritage program might try to promote a give and take between, say, even in the school systems, between the white Anglo kids and the Indian kids, to have a cultural exchange so they understand each other better?
Yeah, I think that would be good, because I think no matter, with the outside world, I'm talking about non-Indians when I say outside, if they don't have it, they always improvise. they'll make up something to get them there. I think that's how you get with your alcohol and drugs, is that they've improvised so much that you take a pill and you're at a certain location that you want to be at, I think, within yourself, I think your body. And I think this has due to because that there's always this improvising that if you don't have it, you can make it. And a lot of times you don't know what the outcome of it is to others, but still you go ahead and proceed with it because you want it. Not what's good for everybody, but just what you want at that time. I think that a lot of big businesses are into money, are one of the areas that people ought to fear, because they thread where the income will be towards them and not the profit. And the profit would be, I think the total loss would be coming to the people. The lands are changing now. We have a lot of nuclear waste dumps. That's really, you know, threading on thin water. We have a lot of areas that are being endangered because of the growth of the building of new homes and condominiums and all this area. I think what we need to do now is to slow down and really start looking at what's going to benefit, I think, next 100 years from now. Everybody visualizes that maybe, you know, we'll go ahead and get what we can out of this and then that'll be over. But Indians have always been a naturalist. They've always been ecologists. They've always taken what they needed, and whatever they didn't need, they just left it alone. And I think it still follows through today. And I don't see anything good coming out of it unless we do stop slowing down and start re-looking at ourselves. And I think that I'm hoping that this exchange type of deal with taking non-Indians into the Indian reservations and taking the Indian kids and taking them to the outside world, making them aware of what's out there, I think it's good because there's a certain giving situation. We had an opportunity to take kids, I think, to different areas over this year, over the summer, to get them aware of what other land looks like. One of the things I found out when I was in Vietnam was that there was a great deal of enjoyment just being in that jungle because of the terrain, the animals, and the whole scene of the animals and everything else was so different that you sat back and just enjoyed what was there. I think the Indian people has always had this built in them to appreciate what was natural. Living out in Big Cypress, which is about 60 miles away, and being isolated. When I used to get on 84 to come down this way, I have a hard time adjusting to the traffic. It's almost like to adjust yourself to, you have to speed up the whole process. Everybody's going so fast and everything. And when you get here, it doesn't stop because everything is still going fast. I think ideas and everything are still flowing. And I think that when you reverse this, when you do slow down, I think that you have more time to think about certain problems. You're not in a hurry to come up with a decision to do certain things because you know the good and the bad parts of it. And I think that this is what has enabled me to look a little bit deeper, I think, within our own people, because I've got this outlet where I can just run back into the woods and everything stops except the birds singing, you know. And I think that's the key for me. But I think other people have to find certain other outlets.
Do you have any questions, Amanda?
No, I think you did a good job. Uh-huh. Answered all the questions
I had.
You
did you did a wonderful job.
Thank you
so much. All You're right. So articulate. You really express yourself so well. I think this will be a terrific part of our show because you're able to really put into words some of those things I was trying to get at, which are so important, like you say, to the mm-hmm. Indians. Your whole your history of being an ecologically minded people, I think that's something that we've got to, we're just beginning to appreciate and realize this is something we've got to get in touch with. We've got to go back and take a look and say, you know, people have lived here for millions of years and all of a sudden we're at a point now where we've got to stop and start again.
Yeah, I think another thing is that, you know, talking about those field trips again, we take kids out.
Uh-huh.
they call them kids, but our young children, we take them out to these areas, which have been inhabited by Indians before they even arrived. But like, one of the areas that we always go to is these burial mounds that were built by the Calusa Indians. And these are pretty interesting to them because they start realizing that they were here first before the white people came. Then now there was somebody here before them. And they have to stop and think, you know, where do I fit in? And it's just building on their I guess, what they're not aware of. I think they're aware up to a certain point. And when they become unaware of what's out there, then they have to start re-educating themselves or restart thinking.
Yeah.
And this is where the traditional people come in because they hold a lot of information, a lot of the stories within themselves. They talk about the other tribes that were here when the Seminoles got here. The Calusa Indians, the big, tall Indians, and they think, well, certain people married to them, and they say, we got some of the tall Indians in here. Mixed marriages have, you know, led people into different areas. And I think that there was a whole mass of people here a lot longer before we even got here. So the land that's out there wasn't owned by us. It wasn't owned by who has it now, but it was owned a long time ago by different people. And these areas should be protected, you know. And I think that's one of the areas that maybe this program will get into is to look at the land and see what it holds. I think that I guess the values are the ones that values, I guess, different from one group of people to another. With me, it would be an old burial ground. That'd be worth something for me. To another person, it would be gold. To another person, it would be silver. And it varies, I guess, values. But these things we can't lose because it's too precious. It we know who we're linked with. I think this is what I'm trying to get at. We know where our origin comes from. We're pretty close to it. And some of the stories, one story I heard not too long ago is this hunter that went out, and it talks about a giant sloth. And that's some time ago, but there's a story that relates to it, and they describe what that giant sloth looks like. And looking back over the history books, you can tell when man was just coming on Earth and when these giant creatures lived. So these are stories that that were kept. These stories were kept, I think, by people who thought it would be important at that time, and just handed down generation to generation to this date. And we start realizing how far back that is. So I'm hoping that this process will keep on going, that we start looking back a little bit more farther into that. I think that's interesting. It's almost when, I guess, the woolly mammoth and the saber-toothed tiger was around. So this is how far that we can be getting stories from. And this is what our older people are giving us. So. Do anything, we need to put them in museums, I think.
They're the living treasures.
Yes, they are.
I know. It's wonderful, though, that these stories are still being told, because so many times they are lost, and once they're lost for one generation, a lot of times they can never be regained again.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, it's amazing to me that they're still being told, because they were never written down.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still not written down.
No.
But they're still alive, and they're still being told.
Yeah. I think right now they're in the process of writing our language down.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like I said, we're combinations of various different groups of people. You take my language, the Miccosukee. And I would speak it differently to other people because their background is a little bit different. And I think that this is a great area that we are making now, is that we're trying to write our history, our language down the way we perceive it to be, the overall basic, I guess, speaking. But there's variations here and there. And if we overlook these variations, then we start, start following, I guess, just to one direct line. Then I think that we're doing the same way with our people then.
Yeah.
Without these variations, I guess these clans and these group of people, that's their identity. And what we're doing when we write the language is that we're erasing some of their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we do write our language, then we're going to have to rewrite it again in those variations to keep those identities.
Right. Is it different, different places where people have probably grown up? They have different ways of expressing certain words.
Yes, it's like it's like the dictionary where I guess you start with the basics, and then you progress upwards.
Yeah.
It's the same way with Indian language also. That there's variations. I think the more you want to express yourself, the certain vocabularies that you use change. And I think that the Indian culture, instead of evolving around what we see today, or understand the evolution of today, they were evolving in a different direction. But that was totally stopped when the wars and everything took place. So they never had a chance to really evolve. And those things you just can't lose, because it's like a like old stone tablets that direct, or I guess you get certain information from, mm-hmm. of the direction that people were headed, and this is what we're getting, upward trend in the Indian culture, mm-hmm. then it stops. So this is where we're at.
Well, are there two languages spoken by the Seminoles?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, Creek and Miccosukee.
And how did this come about?
I believe the Cow Creek, that's the ones up in Brighton. They're mostly from Mississippi.
Oh.
So that's where we get that combination of different tribes coming together and moving down south.
And so do you all have trouble communicating between each other if someone speaks Miccosukee and... Hi. That's Jim Billy.
No, I don't think we have that problem at all. I think there's a good sharing. A lot of them, they speak our language, and some of our people speak their language. I can understand them to a certain point, but they can fluently understand mine.
Yeah. Well, that's neat. That's mm-hmm. great. Well, I think Jim wants to use his office.
Okay,
thank you so
right,
much,
you.
Bob. And as soon as this is done, we'll give you a copy so you can use it in the cultural heritage program.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, okay. I need to cut some logs and everything over in Tampa. For Tampa, I'm starting to build a big Indian hut over there right now.
This is for the museum that.
Well, the museum is being a concrete building, because I don't want a Chiquita type setup for the museum in case I got some nice things in there.
Yeah.
And then we have a shrine type in the middle. We just buried the bones just a couple of days ago, so it's right smack dab in the center of it, and then we're going to have a reflecting pool on top of it, and then I'm looking for. You all might be able to help me on this. I'm looking for a statue of. Somebody that looks like Osceola or look like an Indian. It would be neat if I get a marble statue or a bronze statue, and we'd be glad to pay for it. And we want to put it right in the middle.
There must be sculptors in Florida who could...
Michelangelo's dead
now. Really. Jim, let me just explain what we're doing.
Okay.
We're doing a series of 6 radio programs on traditional culture in Florida. It's the same kinds of things we've been doing all along.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the programs I mentioned to you at the Folk Festival, I thought, after hearing your workshop, I thought it would be terrific to do a program on the cultural heritage of the Seminoles as told by the Seminoles. And talking with David was wonderful. He told us about the program that's going on here at the tribe, and I thought that perhaps we could get with you on, for instance, some of your the legends that you know and some of the stories, and also talk to you generally about what you feel is important to carry on for the tribe itself, and then make an hour-long radio show out of it, and it'll be ready this coming spring. It'll be on National Public Radio, and it'll be offered nationwide, and hopefully it'll be on down here. I know I just saw you on 60 Minutes or one of these programs. Was it either that or PM Magazine, where you were you're having some trouble with a sheriff down here, I understand. Yes, the ongoing saga. Oh, it's really a cowboy and Indian story.
Yeah, the way we figure it out now is our neighbors around here, they go and say something like, yes, the poor, deprived, poverty-stricken Indians, they need to go out there and be self-sufficient. But if they make a dime, they're organized crime.
I know, it sounded, oh, yes. I don't think you have to worry. I don't know. You got a good lawyer on your side.
I just live day to day in politics. You never know what's going to happen. But the promises are just as true as the politician's promises or something like that. Just got to live it. But then that makes me a politician too, so I got to watch what I'm saying.
That's right. You're elected now.
I can't be stereotyping to that.
Right. Well, let me just ask you some general questions first. All right. What is the Seminole Tribe of Florida?
Seminole Tribe of Florida consists of about 1,500 people. We're people who still have the traditional ways of living, legends, stories. Tanning deer hides is no big secret to anybody. Everybody does that, but we still have that type of atmosphere. Few people still live in Indian huts. We still go out there and hunt, but the traditional bow and arrow type hunting does not exist anymore, except for some of us young guys who goes out and buy this new new bows made by Mr. Bear himself, or some fancy compound bows. We go out and hunt with it, but 400 or 500 years, I think, somehow we were introduced to firearms, so we've been using firearms as, you know, a little more accurate than the bow. Garfish. Not eating the rabbit traditionally is still the reason why, as we were told that you shouldn't eat a rabbit because that's the way it was done and that's the way it will be. And I kept wondering why we can't eat rabbits here. What happened, the reason why it stops to what is a Seminole, as you asked me, is that back in the 1800s, somewhere, what particular day they were deported out of Tampa Bay to Louisiana, up to Oklahoma. I don't have the accurate dates on it in my head. I know there's a book around here that says it. Is that it seemed, and the people who departed, who were captured or killed, and the one that survived is the one that we're descendants of right now. It appears that the people who survive here, I don't know what mentality these people had. I don't know what caliber they were, how much medicine they know. I don't know if they knew how much of the legends did they know, or they only knew partials of it, and did the main thinking group of our people were captured and taken to Oklahoma or killed. So in my particular family tree, the only things that they knew, that the legend said that you cannot eat a rabbit, that's the way it will be done, and that's the way it shall be. Now, another camp somewhere far off a distance away will have a different opinion because they might have heard a different part of the legend, and they will eat it. Another group, again, will frown upon totally what we said. So these group of people did not all think as one that I could remember, because, you know, Florida's a big state. If Florida's a big state, different families grew up never seeing each other back in the 1800s, so they have different things. But I finally figured out, I was up in Livingston, Texas one day, and there's a group of Indians there called Quechua Alabamas. They speak a similar language I do. If they talked, I can understand them. So I think it's a group that may had broken off, ran away or something, and went into Texas. And Mr. John Brown, whatever his name, might have took them under his wing. The legend ends up saying the reason why you do not eat rabbits in the state of Florida is because it never gets cold here, and the body temperature is high enough that tapeworm can get into his intestines. And if you cook rabbit, if you're going to eat it all, cook it till it's crisp. And so that leads to another thing, why Indians always eat well-done food. Okay, back in those days, people did eat a lot of well-done food to get away from the different viruses that could be in the meat, but that's the story about the darn rabbit, why we shouldn't eat it. But I eat it because I cook it. I know the different Mr. Louis Pasteur, you know, developed a new theory, but it was the same theory that we had back then, cook it well. Okay. Those type of things still exist, plus many, many more. And the reason why Seminole tribe, the old traditional type living, will probably still exist because there's people like myself and maybe about a third of our tribe who had lived and was raised in a Chiqui hut. One day I wanted to build my village, which is right over here on 441. And I told one of my brother-in-laws, I said, will you organize this? Because he knew that I was become elected chairman now. And I can't work it anymore. But I wanted to set it up exactly the way I pictured it in my brain when I was little. I grew up in my little village. So I built a hut here and I built a hut here, and always the campfire was in the center, the cooking hut. And the reason, and the theory, the reason why we always put the camping fire or the cooking hut in the middle of the camp, it wasn't because it was a nice wheel of life sort of thing in the center, because when during wintertime, when you heated up the, lit up the fire, the heat radiated out and kept the, in the community. So, but then when you think about the old settlers back in Europe, they always put the hearth or I think fireplace somewhere in the middle where the radiation, so it's the same theory. So we're so far apart, but the theories are the same. But anyway, I told my brother when I left there, I said, fix up the village because I can't be here anymore. A year went by and he never did a darn thing to it. And I kept wondering why. What is the matter with my old man, my brother-in-law? And finally dawned on me just this year, what was the matter? He never grew up. He grew up in a CBS home. So there is no way in God's earth he could visually picture an Indian village and feel that nitty-gritty earth when you get up in the morning, you know, the sand, your feet is kind of clean, so you step on the sand, you either touch the earth and you know you've, the earth is warm or the earth is cold, and you can feel the sand get in between your toes, or if it's chicken manure, you feel it right away by making a mistake. He never enjoyed that. So that was the reason. But there's quite a few of us that lives in that matter, and I think we're going to revive it. As long as I'm chairman, I know I'm going to push it. We're going to establish a village out in a Big Cypress community out in a swamp somewhere where it's totally authentic.